Part 3, 1815 to 1863. Chapter 8, The Cause of Learning. If ignorance could be banished from our land, a real millennium would commence. Ephraim Cutler. 1. The home ground Dr. Hildreth returned to that spring of 1815 was in many ways, as was being said, a new Ohio. With the end of the War of 1812 came a great sense of relief that the threats of British invasion and native resistance were over, and almost at once came a pronounced surge of optimism and in the economy, production, investments, and confidence in the future. The Ohio River had become one of the especially great thoroughfares, the traffic greater than ever, the flow of freight in both directions such as never seen. The mass movement of American settlers heading west, now numbering in the thousands, seemed to grow by the week, and was supplemented by unprecedented numbers of immigrants from England, Scotland, Ireland, and Germany. By 1815, Ohio's population was approximately 500,000, and still growing. Cincinnati had become the fastest-growing city in America. But still more of the settlers traveling the river were bound for the territory beyond. In 1816, with a population of about 65,000, Indiana would become a state. In 1818, Illinois, too, would become a state, its population having reached approximately 35,000. More steamboats traveled in both directions. Their chugging engines and whistles, and increasing noise, had become a part of the scene. At Pittsburgh, Wheeling, and Cincinnati, still more and larger steamboats were in production. One being built at Wheeling, called the Washington, would be, at 201 tons, the largest steamboat yet on the Western rivers, the first double-decker, and driven by a stern paddle wheel fully 12 feet wide, which was thought remarkable. It also had two smokestacks instead of one, a pilot house, elegantly appointed cabins, and included a commodious bar room. On Monday, June 3, 1816, the all-new, much-anticipated Washington left Wheeling on her maiden voyage down the Ohio with Captain Henry M. Shreve, her part owner and builder, in command. On June 4, she anchored off Point Harmer. Then, the next morning, Wednesday, June 5, with steam up and all hands on deck weighing anchor, the boiler at the stern exploded with tremendous force, sending scalding water over many of those on deck and blowing Captain Shreve and a number of the crew overboard. "It was terrible beyond conception," declared one contemporary account. A half dozen or more of the victims were nearly skinned from head to foot. In stripping off their clothes, their skin peeled off with them. The screams and groans of the agonizing sufferers made the scene even more horrible. Several people died, and more died later from the severity of their wounds. It was the worst steamboat disaster in the country until then. Yet except for the boiler that exploded, there had been no damage to the ship, and in only a few weeks the Washington continued on down the Ohio and the Mississippi to New Orleans. Even more remarkably, the Washington made the trip back up the river in the record time of 24 days. Nor was there any let-up in steam traffic on the rivers or the building of more steamboats, or any end to steamboat accidents. The importance of the Ohio as a highway, indeed, as a way of life, continued only to expand. In a matter of 3 years, there would be 63 steamboats on the river. Such boats could do about 50 miles a day, or more than twice the fastest moving barge or keelboat. In another few years, some of the newest steamboats on the Ohio could travel 100 miles in a day. 2. The rapidly growing state's capital, had been moved once again to a new location. This time it was a new town called Columbus at the center of the state. There was nothing especially impressive or inspiring about the new capital, a modest two-story brick building clearly intended to serve the purpose for the time being only, as all taking part seemed to understand. Ephraim Cutler arrived there on December 5, 1819, and was at first most pleasantly surprised by just about everything. "Several friends called on me that evening and gave me a welcome I did not expect," he wrote to his wife, Sally. Almost immediately, with no trouble whatever, he found lodging in a house very pleasantly situated, and all much to his liking. "No other member boards with me, but there are 50 within a few steps. I have the benefit of retirement in the midst of bustle and noise." He urged her to write soon and let him know every feeling of your heart, and if my dear children ever think of their father. Writing to Sally 2 weeks later, Ephraim said he had found some agreeable, respectable men among the members whose company he enjoyed, but that on the whole there is an unaccountable procrastination which is disgusting to me. Nothing of a public nature had yet been accomplished. As would be said of Ephraim Cutler, he always wanted to do what was right. And as he had in his earlier years in the legislature battled to keep slavery out of Ohio, so now he had returned to politics determined to make possible the establishment of a public school system for the state. He felt it essential and long past due, and he intended to make it happen. On December 24th, he was extremely pleased to report to Sally, "I am appointed on a very important committee, who have under consideration a bill to regulate schools." Already he was drawing up a bill, which I hope will be so constructed as to pass and to produce a good effect. Then suddenly, in a matter of days, and greatly to his surprise, all seemed to change. On the evening of December 29th, in the privacy of his room at the boarding house, he poured out his anger in a long letter to Sally over the thick-headed mortals and knaves of politics. "I have just returned from attending a meeting of our committee, and all is hushed in slumber in the adjoining rooms. The difficulty in making thick-headed mortals understand plain questions is sometimes vexing. But this evening, our committee has had to contend with art and avarice combined. There is nowhere to be found knaves more designing than at a legislature, where designing scoundrels lurk, and with specious words and demure looks, they calculate to entrap the unwary, and like bloodsuckers, leech and suck the public." He was fed up, truly tired of it. "My head, hands, and even heart are engaged in the labors before me." But by no means did he consider giving up. With his New England background, his devotion to the cause of learning was no less than ever. "I am not without hopes," he assured her, "of effecting a change in our system of taxation and of getting a law passed for establishing school districts and encouraging schools." On the matter of taxation, he had already had to combat, alone, all who spoke out in the House. When it came to the first vote, 22 others voted with him, and 40 against. On the second vote, it was clear his side was making progress, 28-4 and 32 against. Among those who spoke out in favor of public schools was Joseph Barker, who had also become a member of the House. As his daughter would one day recall, his speech had been written in the hope that the poor, as well as the rich, might receive the advantage of education. Well into the new year, on January 21, 1820, Ephraim wrote again to his wife to express little hope for the public school bill. "I am oppressed with a responsible situation which I am in. There is a bill before the House for regulating schools, on which I have spent many painful thoughts and hours of labor. I expect to lose it, and dread the day when I must exert all my poor ability to again defend it." He went on to say, a bill for building a canal from Lake Erie to the Ohio River was before the House and another source of anxiety for him. He opposed it and felt alone in that position, but I must do the best I can. Sally, too, had much on her mind, much to contend with at home, but wanted him to know she understood the situation he was in and that he had her support. As to the frequent use of your oratorical abilities, she wrote on January 23, 1820, I have only to say, if by exercise they brighten, pray continue to pour forth your eloquence. If not, desist. Nor vainly think the merit of your cause, unless ably and smartly defended, will have any effect on such opponents as I fear you have to deal with. Men who will waste their breath and prostitute their talents to deprive a fellow mortal of that which is their birthright. 3 days later, on January 26th, she wrote again to say she hoped he would be home soon to transact business at home himself to more advantage. I can truly say I am tired of it. A constant fear of doing something wrong continually perplexes me. How did the thought of home affect him? She asked. Your children all love and long to see their father. As for myself, you know my feelings better than I can describe them. On January 28th, Ephraim was writing to her again, this time in an entirely different spirit. The act for regulating schools, which I originated, and that I now feel gratitude to God for sustaining me in carrying through, has passed the House. Yeas, 40, nays, 20. An editorial in the Cincinnati Inquisitor, one of the most influential newspapers in the state, voiced strong approval of a public system of education, saying that advantages to be gained were too generally known to need comments. We seek no further proof in favor of schools supported by law than the estimation in which they are held by older states of the Union. Wherever they have been admitted, they have never been abandoned, but are universally cherished. Ephraim's active involvement with the creation of Ohio University had also become greater than ever. In 1816, work was proceeding on the first building on the campus, on the high ground of the College Green, as it was called. On August 27, 1818, writing to Ephraim from Hamilton, his father bemoaned the total neglect he had received concerning the part he had played in the founding of the university. He went on about it at some length, reminding Ephraim that the establishment of a university was a first object and lay with great weight on my mind. Age and failing health were increasing realities for Manasseh. His wife and Ephraim's mother, Mary Balt Cutler, had died 3 years before at 74. Her death was as surprising to me as if she had been in perfect health, Manasseh had written to Ephraim, but have the firm hope that my loss is her infinite gain. I think I can say the will of the Lord be done. I am just going off the stage, he now told Ephraim, and any mark of respect that can be shown to me in this world I consider of very little consequence to myself, but maybe of some to my posterity. Such as the name of some building, he wrote, reminding Ephraim that this was long the custom in all the colleges in New England. The new building, now nearly finished, was a fine three-story red brick structure with a tall clock tower referred to only as the college edifice. What Ephraim may have written to his father in response, or how much say Ephraim may have had in the naming of the building, is not known. The wait for a decision went on, and sadly, Manasseh Cutler would not live to hear his wish fulfilled. Not until 1914 would the centerpiece of the university officially become Cutler Hall in his honor. He had been suffering severely for years from lung disease, asthma, with spasms of difficulty in breathing and excruciating pains in the chest. yet he maintained his customary cheerfulness and interest in life. In his diary on September 11, 1821, he wrote, "This day, it is 50 years since I was ordained in this place. My state of health renders it impracticable to take any public notice of the day. How wonderful that my life should be prolonged to this day! How much I have to be thankful for, and much to be humble for!" Finally, after 52 years at the pulpit, he had to step down. He died on July 28, 1823, at the age of 81. An old friend, the Reverend Benjamin Wadsworth, preached his funeral service before a full church. Long obituaries appeared in papers throughout New England, many listing at length the numerous citations and awards conferred on him, the honorary degrees received from Harvard and Yale for work he had done in medicine and the natural sciences. Yet for all that, little or nothing was said of the all-important part he had played in the creation and enactment of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 and the settlement of Ohio. One notable exception would not appear until much later in a national publication, The American Naturalist, calling Manasseh Cutler not only a pioneer in a new country, not merely a pioneer in science, but a pioneer for truth and civilization in every form, and credited him for the clause in the Northwest Ordinance declaring there would be no slavery. Meanwhile, life went on in Marietta. A steady flow of news, good and bad, filled the pages of the American Friend, a local paper. There seemed no end of weddings, divorces, fires, crimes committed, including murder, and tragic accidents. Drowned on Thursday the 30th, Mr. Samuel McClintock, a respectable citizen of this town. Drowned on Friday last, Jane Murray, aged between 2 and 3 years. Drowned on Sunday the 16th in the Ohio River, Mr. John Walsh, a native of Canada. Rewards were announced by Sheriff Timothy Buell for a criminal prisoner who broke out of the Marietta jail, one Samuel Berry, described as about 5 feet 8 inches tall, with dark small eyes, who, like an experienced villain, will betray you with a smile. As for public announcements of marriages, separation, or divorce, the standard form published in the paper would declare, "Whereas my wife Eliza has left my bed and board without any just cause, this is to warn all persons against harboring or trusting her on my account, as I will not pay any debts of her contracting from the time of her leaving me." Then followed Eliza's response, "Reader, I will state that you are wrongly informed, for I have neither left bed nor board. My bed I took with me, and board I had none. He neither provided me with victuals or drink more than one half the time since we were married. He came home on Saturday, and Sunday morning he could not think of returning back to work without expressing some of his kind affection to me. So he whipped me and kicked me out of doors, without any provocation. He immediately sold his farm and put the rest of the property out of his hands, and of course I had neither board nor home. Therefore, my husband Eliad has absconded, and I forbid all persons trusting or harboring him on my account, for I will not pay any debts of his contracting. I will give 1/2 cent reward for said Eliad Thomas, but neither thanks or charges." There were reports of counterfeit $5 bills making an appearance in town. Of course, thievery, even a bank robbery, and the reward of $1,000 offered after the cashier of the Muskingum Bank, one David J. Maple, made off with $15,000 to $20,000. A description was provided of both the culprit and the small sorrel horse he rode away on. Warnings, too, were posted on a habitual absconder calling himself Seth Lothrop, a cabinet maker who had taken off, leaving his creditors unpaid. "This running away has been so often repeated," said the announcement, "as to have become a habit, and the good people of Ohio would do well to be upon their guard. It may well be said of him that he run so long and run so fast, no wonder he ran out at last. He run in debt and then to pay, he distance all and run away." The summer of 1820 was distinguished by uncommon heat and lack of rain. The temperature on August 10th was 98 degrees in the shade. The summer of 1821 was no better. By the summer of 1822, the mighty Ohio River had become a mere brook, lower than ever known at Marietta. The water, nearly stagnant in some places, produced a noxious smell in the air that became a cause of much concern. As Samuel Hildreth was to write, in this poisonous gas, no doubt, the seeds of fever were contained. Potato bugs were in multitude such as never seen. Toward autumn, the country was overrun with gray squirrels, their line of march from north to south. No obstacles obstructed their course, often passing through or over the houses of the inhabitants, and swimming the Ohio River in its widest places, Samuel Hildreth recorded. In the later part of June, fevers began, typhoid in particular. Then followed a full-scale influenza epidemic, a terrible visitation of burning fever, wild delirium, and deathly chills. No family and few individuals escaped. More than 500 people took sick, and more than 70 in Marietta died, including many children. All business stopped. The town's newspaper, American Friend, shut down because of illness to the staff, except for one boy, which probably explains why there had been no obituary of Manasseh Cutler in the paper. Physicians were overworked. Samuel Hildreth, who had more than 600 patients under his care, refused to take any payment for his services. Paul Fearing, the first lawyer among the earliest settlers, and who became a widely respected judge of the Court of Common Pleas, and his wife were both victims of the epidemic. Dr. Jabez True, the first physician, whose friendship had meant so much to Samuel Hildreth, was another who died. Ephraim and Sally Cutler and their family were sick and recovered, but for one son, 12-year-old Manasseh, who died that October 1822. The grief in the family was overwhelming, and for Sally most of all. 3 months later, in a letter to Ephraim, who was back at Columbus serving in the legislature, she wrote that she could not stop thinking of and longing for our dear departed son. "I think I see his animated countenance, his noble mien. The arms of maternal tenderness are extended in vain to embrace the beloved child. The next moment, my gloomy thoughts are transported to the silent grave where he sleeps in the dust. The sorrows of a mother are beyond all human consolation." The epidemic had proved so dreadful, it became widely assumed that once over, nothing like it would strike again for a long time. Even Samuel Hildreth, when his father expressed a desire to come out to Ohio for a first visit the following spring of 1823, saw no reason for him not to. "My father concluded to make a visit to Ohio, not only to see his son in Marietta, but also to view the rich valleys of the West, which had for many years excited his curiosity," Hildreth later wrote. His journey out was performed very comfortably in a small covered one-horse wagon. The visit was very pleasant to him, and the time passed rapidly away until the fore part of August, when the country became the seat of a violent epidemic fever. The year before had been very sickly, but this year it was still worse. As one resident wrote, "At Marietta, the people at last thought no more of seeing a corpse go on the street than seeing a dog run. One house they took out a man's wife and buried her. When they came home from the funeral and found her husband was dead, the people set to and made a coffin and buried him. The elder Hildreth fell victim to the epidemic and died on August 6, 1823. His health was generally firm and good, his son wrote, and but for this attack, he might in all probability have lived a number of years. He was buried in the Mound Cemetery. But for Marietta, greatest was the loss of the most notable and admired of the first pioneers, General Rufus Putnam, who died not of epidemic fever, but old age, at 86 on May 4, 1824. No one had played so important a role in the creation of the settlement or shown such leadership, perseverance, and strength of character without fail. Word of his death moved the community in ways nothing had. His obituary, in effect a full biography, ran in installments for days in the Gazette. So, too, did news of his death and tributes to his life appear in numerous papers in the East. He was hailed as the fast friend of Washington and the pride of the army. One particular acclamation that appeared many times said simply, "He did honor to human nature." He was rightly lauded as the originator of the whole idea of a new future in Ohio country, beginning with the Newburgh Petition before the end of the Revolution. He it was who led the way from the first meeting at the Bunch of Grapes Tavern in Boston that gave rise to the Ohio Company, who drew his own early map of the area, drew up the plan for the city upon the hill, and who led the first of the New England pioneers. Through every variety of adversity and struggle, through every step forward to the ideals of a new start, he had maintained his strong sense of purpose. He would widely be remembered for having once issued a directive to deliver to a Delaware woman, the widow of a murdered Indian, such goods as she shall choose to wipe away her tears to the amount of $5. He had designed and built Campus Martius, and wanted always to be fair in his dealings with the native tribes, and he provided much-needed, sound leadership through the dark time of the Indian Wars. He had led the way in establishing Marietta's first school, its first church, first bank, served in the state legislature as an ardent supporter of the first state university, and, with Ephraim Cutler, stood firm against the acceptance of slavery in Ohio. He would be admired and long remembered, too, for his way of life, how he surrounded his modest but commodious dwelling with fruit trees of his own planting, and that finer or more loaded orchards than his no country could offer. In the midst of rural plenty and endeared friends, who had grown up around him, far from the display of wealth, the bustle of ambition and intrigue, the father of the colony, hospitable and kind, without ostentation and without effort, he displayed in these remote regions the grandeur, real and intrinsic, of those immortal men who achieved our revolution. In a book Samuel Hildreth was to write on the pioneers of Marietta, a collection of 38 biographical sketches, the first and longest was by far that of Rufus Putnam, with whom Hildreth had spent many hours in conversation. Along with so much else that was admirable, the general was highly interesting, possessing a rich fund of anecdote and valuable facts in the history of men, and that the impress of his character is strongly marked on the population of Marietta, in their buildings, institutions, and manners. After the death of his wife, Persis Rice Putnam, in 1820, their eldest, an unmarried daughter, Elizabeth, kept house and looked after him in the same family home he had built as part of Campus Martius. Sarah Cutler Dawes, the daughter of Ephraim Cutler, would later recall staying there overnight. The general shook her hand a long time and said, "And are you Ephraim Cutler's daughter?" and kept shaking her hand. He was quite deaf, feeble with age, but also erect in his carriage and dignified in manner. He asked a blessing at table, standing himself at the head of the table while we all stood up by the side of our chairs. At night, he had family prayers. We all stood up during the service, which was conducted by the general. She saw him, too, at church service. He would walk up the aisle with great dignity, and all the people seemed to pay him deference. On the matter of advancing age, he liked to say, "My son is far past its meridian." More than half a century later, in 1881, historian H. Z. Williams would write in his History of Washington County, Ohio, a concise, highly insightful tribute to both Manasseh Cutler and Rufus Putnam. Dr. Cutler and General Putnam were from first to last the leading spirits of the Ohio Company, the office of the former being principally the management of the difficult and delicate negotiations with the general government, and that of the latter, the superintendency of the internal affairs of the organization. The relations of the two men were intimate and cordial. Each seems to have entertained the most thorough respect for the other. Yet they were as dissimilar as two men well could be. One was thoroughly educated, cultured, accomplished. The other, a strong, rugged man, almost entirely lacking in knowledge, save by the kind acquired little by little in the experience of life, but full of wisdom, possessing the genius of uncommon common sense, great strength of purpose, and vast executive ability. Either of these men would undoubtedly have made a failure in the position of the other, but in the places which they did occupy, no men could have been more efficient. As General Putnam had requested, there was no public event commemorating his life, only a funeral service at the Congregational Church, where a large crowd attended. He was buried at the Old Mound Cemetery, where a plain but substantial marble tombstone was erected. He was survived by 3 daughters and 2 sons, 30 grandchildren, and 21 great-grandchildren. In his last will and testament, he gave 348 acres of land to 3 grandsons and left money for the education of poor children in Marietta and for the support of missionaries to preach the gospel in places destitute of a settled minister or among the Indian tribes. The modest inventory of items he owned at his death included 1 old black horse, 1 musket, 1 axe, 1 broad axe, 1 surveyor's chain, 1 hoe, 1 pitchfork, 1 plow, 6 cider barrels, 1 grindstone, 2 old scythes, 1 handsaw. The contents of his library of more than 70 books included 1 Bible, 2 volumes of the Lewis and Clark journals, a copy of The History of the First Settlement, 2 psalm books and 2 singing books, 1 copy of the Constitution of the United States, 1 French grammar, Milton's Paradise Lost, 1 copy of The Art of War, a treatise on fortifications, and a military dictionary, 2 volumes of the Letters of George Washington. The summer following Rufus Putnam's death, the Marquis de Lafayette arrived at Long Island, New York, to begin a nationwide tour of the United States like nothing ever before or since. The symbol of a heroic past, he was to be celebrated at age 67, wherever he went, 1 stop after another. Nearly a year later, on the morning of May 23, 1825, a small steamboat, the Herald, was heading upstream on the Ohio, carrying Lafayette on the last leg of the tour. Until then, it was generally understood that Marietta was not to be part of the itinerary, and no preparations had been made. 2 or 3 miles below town, a gun was fired on the Herald, which was supposed to signal that Lafayette was on board, and as the boat approached the landing, a sign could be seen across the bow, General Lafayette, that put aside all doubt. More cannon were fired as Lafayette came ashore. Bells rang as virtually the whole town flocked to greet him, all eager, as said, to seize his hand and welcome him to the soil he so nobly defended. The crowd arranged itself in two lines, down which and back Lafayette passed to shake hands with each and all, grasping the hands of the few veterans of the Revolution there to pay their respects. He seemed unwilling to let go. A list of nearly 50 military officers who had been among the pioneers who settled Marietta was read to him, including most prominently General Rufus Putnam. "I knew them well," Lafayette said. "They were the bravest of the brave." At the conclusion of this, saying he could stay no longer, Lafayette departed on the Herald, and, as it was reported, practically the whole population of Marietta cheered on the shore. Of the many residents of Marietta and the surrounding towns and farms and cabins in the woods, for whom Samuel Hildreth served as the family physician, the Joseph Barkers counted high among his favorites. He and Barker had discovered quickly how much they had in common, and particularly in their love of books and history. Hildreth convinced Barker that he was a natural writer and must put down on paper his story and in his own way. Hildreth had also been extremely grateful during the recent epidemics to have had Barker's daughter, Catherine, come stay with the Hildreth family in Marietta and help serve as a nurse. The doctor was then working 16 to 18 hours a day, attending more than 600 patients. Also, like so many others, Hildreth was a great admirer of Barker's talents as architect and builder. And so to Barker, he turned to design and build a new Hildreth residence for an enlarged family, now counting 5 children, as well as a new doctor's office. In the years since his work on the Blennerhassett Mansion and boats for Aaron Burr, Barker had been extremely busy designing and building more houses, as well as a second courthouse on Putnam Street, the old courthouse having become too small for the growing town. The Hildreth project was a major undertaking, one of the largest houses in Marietta and located beside the new courthouse. The cost would be covered in large part by labor donated by patients of Hildreth's, unable to pay for the care he had provided during the epidemic. Work began the summer of 1824 and became the subject of considerable attention. The house was to have much the look of Barker's other houses, built of brick and in the federal style, with large recessed windows, a front door with fluted columns, a fanlight over the door, and the windows above. It was 3 stories with a 2-story wing to the rear. Grander in scale than any of his previous in-town houses, it more than qualified as a mansion. Once finished in 1826, it counted as one of the town's showpieces. One young lady from New England, a teacher new to the town, who was invited by the Hildreths for an afternoon visit, would write at length about the pleasure of sitting in their spacious garden. "We passed nearly an hour," she wrote. "It is filled with peach, quince, pear, and apple trees, loaded with fruit, a great profusion of grapes of 10 different kinds, flowers of indigenous and exotic origin, comprising a variety of 200, and under the shade of the grapevines, a number of beehives, loaded with flowers and invitations to come again. We bade them good night, very much pleased with our call." As time went on, the house was also to become known as a center of medical and scientific collections and innovative ideas, the production center of countless medical and scientific articles by the doctor, as well as works of history, not to say a professional medical office. But primarily it was a home, and there Hildreth was to live for almost 40 more years. 3. In the fall of 1823, at the age of 56, Ephraim Cutler had been re-elected to the state legislature, only this time to the Senate, and by a resounding margin. He arrived back in Columbus that December, and in a letter to Sally, reported that while he was as yet little acquainted with the new members, he thought favorably of them. "So far as I am able to form a judgment, there is as much talent, harmony, and industry as is usually assembled in the legislature." His main purpose was to achieve as much as possible in the cause of education, in a state public school system and the university. "I have a strong hope we shall accomplish something." 2 weeks later, he could report that never in his life had he been placed in a situation so arduous and difficult as he had faced this whole session. He had first wanted to attain Senate backing for increased financial support for the university, and found himself put constantly on the defensive and had to parry, answer, and sometimes retort attacks. But he succeeded. The vote was a decisive 23-10. In favor of an appropriation of $3,000. He was also serving on the school committee and as chairman of the revenue committee, two of the most important roles of that session, and had already finished one report on the subject and had another nearly ready, and he was exhausted. Two others on the committee he found he greatly liked, both fellow New Englanders, who felt as he did about the critical need for public schools. Caleb Atwater, the chairman of the committee, had been born in North Adams, Massachusetts, and graduated from Williams College. He had come to Ohio in 1811 and settled in Circleville, about 23 miles to the north of Chillicothe, where he practiced law and served as postmaster. Nathan Guilford, senator from Hamilton County and a resident of Cincinnati, had grown up in Spencer, Massachusetts, and Ephraim thought highly of him, a fine man and most efficient supporter. As the three of them were quite aware, the reality of education in Ohio was far from the ideal expressed in the Northwest Ordinance, that schools and education shall forever be encouraged. The gap between the dream and the reality was immense. Ohio was, in fact, without a school system, except for a few enterprising towns like Marietta, as well as Cincinnati and Cleveland, where schools were local creations. In the northeastern corner of the state on Lake Erie, Cleveland had a population of little more than 1,000, but also one of the best harbors on the lake and was growing rapidly. That the master of the academy in Marietta, David Putnam, the grandson of General Israel Putnam, and a graduate of Yale, taught classes ranging from penmanship to astronomy and grammar in English, Greek, and Latin, was hardly representative of Ohio teachers in general. Good teachers were hard to find. A great many were just ordinary, or less, someone of little or no training or prior experience, and who made an agreement to keep school. Those who sent their children to attend usually paid a fee of $1 to $3 a year. In towns and villages, classes were taught in private homes or over places of business, in basements and churches. In the countryside, vacant cabins and abandoned barns often served the purpose. The usual school building or schoolhouse was no more than a one-room log cabin, extremely simple and uncomfortable, measuring about 15 by 28 feet, with a dirt floor. The furniture consisted principally of rude benches without backs, made of splitting logs lengthwise into halves and mounting them, flat side up, on four legs or pins driven into the ground. Desks, similarly, though less clumsily made, were sometimes furnished to the big boys and girls. The room, or at least one end of it, was heated with an immense fireplace. There was no blackboard, no apparatus of even the rudest description to assist the teacher in expounding the lessons. The curriculum consisted of reading, spelling, writing, and arithmetic, and in some districts, a rule in force prohibited the teaching of anything more. Reading and spelling were the great tests of learning. To master arithmetic as well was to have acquired an education. Settlers who had been educated in the East often saw their children growing up illiterate. But great, too, were the number of settlers who had no wish to see their taxes raised. Among the German immigrants were many who disliked the very idea of their children learning to read English. For Ephraim, as it had been for his father, the cause of education, like that of excluding slavery from Ohio, was a cause never to be abandoned. But also, as with Rufus Putnam and Joseph Barker, it was because he himself had had such a scanty education and well knew the barriers that could present. That there was nothing limited about his vocabulary is evident throughout. Words like discretion, mitigate, and inestimable appear frequently and naturally. But then he read constantly and had built his own substantial library. Spelling, however, remained a continuous problem, as he knew. He wrote of the hollow compliments or blarney which I sometimes meet with here. Meet, M-E-A-T, hear, H-E-A-R. Or times of difficulty. The word get invariably appears as git, G-I-T or G-I-T-T. In years to come, in a book prepared largely from his letters and journals by his daughter Julia, misspelling and syntax were all touched up. In what had been his first love letter to Sally, written 17 years before, Ephraim had told her that the heart, when full to overflowing, seeks a vent, and that nothing relieved it so effectively as to pour out our thoughts to one we love. Now he was pouring them out to her full force in letter after letter. He was laboring incessantly, allowing himself no more than 4 hours sleep a night for 3 weeks. Friends told him he looked sick, but his bodily health was fine, he assured her. Not only my reputation, but the good of my country is at stake, and much depends upon how I am able to discharge my duty. 2 nights later, at the end of another exhausting day, he wrote again. He was still struggling with the tax laws. You know when my mind is intensely engaged, I can neither eat nor sleep. One cup of coffee in the morning, one of tea at supper, with little else, and an equally light dinner. I regret that I undertook this immense labor. I despair of effecting the passage of these laws this session. But some good may hereafter grow out of bringing the subject fairly and fully before the public. Still, again, 2 days after that, he was declaring himself entirely insufficient to sustain the load he carried. If he had more sensibility, he would undoubtedly sink under it. For one person, alone, to attempt to change the whole revenue system of a great and powerful state, almost without a hint from another, and to have the temerity to think that his crude and perhaps badly digested notions can be made to succeed, may well be considered by a sober, reflecting mind to border on madness. But he felt himself on a mission of high purpose, and he would not give up. Your husband has undertaken this unpromising thing, and that he feels the pressure of such a mountain, you may well imagine. I am encouraged by believing that the cause is one of the highest importance to my country, and that from its success, great benefits will result in relieving the poor from their burdens, by providing an equitable way to call forth the revenue of the state, and thus provide for the support of schools and seminaries of learning, and for making roads, canals, etc. She worried intensely about him, as she would write, "To say that I am concerned about your health would be but a faint expression of my uneasiness on that account. I regret that it is not in my power to attend on you and administer those little offices of kindness which is so necessary in your situation, and which delicacy forbids you to ask of another. It seems as if Providence has designed we should not live much together. To this I must quietly submit, although it is, and ever has been, a source of regret and uneasiness. Though he knew how his absence from home compounded the difficulties Sally had to contend with herself, as she confided in her correspondence, he often failed to respond as quickly or sympathetically as he could have, so preoccupied, so totally distracted could he become with his situation of the moment. It was a side of him, memorably illustrated by an incident that took place during a stay at Athens, when he had gone there to take part in a transaction of important business for the future of the university. One morning, he was seen by others at the house where he was staying, sitting down by himself after breakfast for the perusal of the Bible. According to one account, he continued to read in an absorbed silence hour after hour until late in the forenoon, when it occurred to his friends that he might be regarding the day as the Sabbath. Following dinner, he seated himself once more with his Bible, but before night, he was told directly it was Friday, not Sunday. He had, he said, been a little troubled in his mind that the church bells did not ring. In a letter written February 12, 1824, as the legislative session was about to end, Ephraim could report to Sally only that his expectations regarding appropriations for Ohio University had been dashed to the ground by the House of Representatives. "These matters," he said, "will be themes of discussion between us, if Providence kindly permits me to return to my home once more." The next session of the legislature convened at Columbus on December 6, 1824, and Senator Ephraim Cutler was full ready to get back to work. A canal bill and a new system of taxation were now the absorbing subjects. The prospect of building a canal from the Ohio River to Lake Erie, a massive and extremely costly project, had great appeal to many. The need for an equal system of taxation was for Ephraim the favorite wish of my heart, along with, no less than ever, statewide, state-financed public education. Caleb Atwater, who knew as well as anyone what he had been through, sent him a heartfelt note of praise of the kind one never forgets. "Dear sir, you are doing nobly. Press forward with your equal taxation, the school system, and the canals, and immortalize this legislature. What must be your sensations on the prospect you now have of carrying into effect the three greatest objects ever presented to our legislature? Press forward, I say, in your career of doing good. Posterity will call you blessed." Now, in return for their vote on the canal bill, the representatives from Marietta, led by Ephraim Cutler, demanded a new tax to support statewide public education. And unpopular as a school tax was, a bargain was struck. "I have little doubt the revenue law will be made to my mind, and also a free school system," Ephraim wrote to Sally on January 23, 1825, adding, "The canal bill will, of course, pass, which is also important." All three bills, on equal taxation, on the canal, and on the school tax, passed in both houses. On the day the school bill finally passed in the House, Ephraim, deeply anxious over the fate of the bill, was present to witness the moment. Standing beside him, equally interested, was Nathan Guilford, the senator from Cincinnati. When the result was announced, Ephraim turned and, raising his hand, said, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation." Through all this, meanwhile, Ephraim had been giving additional attention and effort to furthering the cause of higher education. At a meeting with other trustees of the university held in Columbus in 1824, He had taken part in the selection of a first president of the university, the Reverend Robert G. Wilson, a Presbyterian pastor from Chillicothe. When the inaugural ceremonies took place at Athens, it was he who presented the keys and the university charter to Dr. Wilson, then delivered the welcoming address, citing the university as a fulfillment of the high hopes of the original pioneers for the blessings of an enlightened education. In early 1829, Ephraim Cutler's youngest son, William, would enter Ohio University as a freshman. No annual event in Marietta compared to the Washington County Agricultural Fair. It was the biggest, most high-spirited community gathering of the year, with all ages, trades, professions, every walk of life in attendance. And the Agricultural Fair of the year 1829 was the biggest yet, and included a speech by Ephraim Cutler that was to be long remembered and talked about. The day was fair, but unusually cool for the time of year, as reported in the American Friend and Marietta Gazette. Attendance was full and included a considerable number of strangers. All seemed happy, a good sign. The hilarity and good feeling exhibited on such occasions cannot but be productive of beneficial effects to society. The sober, steady, and industrious citizens of our own county are so little accustomed to periods of relaxation or holidays, and we have so few of them generally as a nation, that it is no wonder that foreigners on their first arrival amongst us should view us with astonishment, as a people whose sober and grave faces were never lighted up with a smile, and whose thoughts were wholly given to business or something of more serious import. The fair itself included exhibits and contests aplenty. Some of the first merino sheep ever seen west of the Alleghenies were on display. There were rugs and beautiful woolen blankets, the snowy whiteness and handsomely ornamented corners of which would lose nothing in comparing with the very best of imported articles of this kind. There were highly popular plowing matches contested with great spirit and skillful exertion. As few were to forget, one mammoth yellow squash on display weighed 96 pounds and measured 5 feet 11 inches and was 24 inches in circumference. Among the awards bestowed was one to Joseph Barker, Jr., for his apples, and to Colonel Ichabod Nye for the best sole leather. Ephraim Cutler's speech was delivered to a full gathering in the Congregational Church. The fact that there was no written history as yet of the founding of the Marietta settlement, and that most of the original pioneers had by now passed on, led him to address the subject as no one yet had. He spoke at length and with deep feeling. It is said that certain epochs in the history of nations will always attract to themselves a lasting interest, he said. Among other things, their origin awakens lively curiosity. From whence did they spring? At what period was their country settled? For what causes, under what circumstances, and for what objects were difficulties met and overcome? The toils and misfortunes incident to new settlements. The slow progress of even successful effort, he continued, the patience, fortitude, and sagacity by which evils are overcome or diminished, the causes which quicken or retard their growth, all furnish lessons which improve the wise, correct the rash, and alarm the improvident. He went on to describe the veterans of the Revolution who founded the Ohio Company, talked of General Putnam, Colonel Sproat, Captain Jonathan Duval, and the others who led the way, seven of whom, as he said, were still alive. He quoted the tribute spoken by the good Lafayette during his visit to Marietta. Then, in conclusion, he said there was another subject he wished he had the powers of eloquence to enforce, and that was the importance of cultivating the mind. for the purpose of improved cultivation of farms, great and lasting advantages could be gained from scientific knowledge. A knowledge of geology and chemistry would enable the farmer to learn the nature of the soil he possessed. 41 years earlier, during his one visit to the new Western settlement, the Reverend Manasseh Cutler had preached a powerful sermon at Campus Martius, in which he said that with the establishment of religious freedom and learning, a new nation was at hand. Now, speaking from the congregational pulpit, Ephraim expressed his earnest wish that this enlightened audience will all join me in declaring that if ignorance could be banished from our land, a real millennium would commence. Less than 6 years later would follow the founding of Marietta College, a natural outgrowth of the settlement. The purpose was to establish a genuine college of the New England type. In time to come, members of the faculty and the Board of Trustees included graduates of Dartmouth, Amherst, Yale, Princeton, and Harvard. Members of the Putnam and Cutler families would take part, along with Samuel Hildreth and Caleb Emerson, serving on the board and as substantial donors. Its first graduating class of 1838 numbered only 4, but it was to keep growing.